The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Market insight and analysis. You're listening to the opening bell of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Good Wednesday morning, everybody, and welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm David Faber, along with Morgan Brennan and Mike Santoli. Carl and Jim both have the morning off this morning. Let's give you a look at futures, of course, as we get ready. We got two more trading days of the year, right? Yeah, there it is. We look like we're going to have a slightly higher open at this point after yet another gain yesterday for these record-setting markets. Let's get to our roadmap this morning. And it begins with some news out late yesterday involving, well, potential changes or at least an activist campaign at Intel, Third Point calling on the chipmaker to explore strategic alternatives.
Then a green light for AstraZeneca and Oxford's COVID-19 vaccine in the UK as the country deals with another surge of cases and a new variant of the coronavirus.
And finally, futures pointing to a higher open this morning, as David just mentioned. The Dow, S&P, NASDAQ closed lower for the first time in several sessions yesterday.
And let's start there, of course, with those markets. As Mike just mentioned, futures indicating stocks near record highs in today's session as we do count down the end of 2020. Thankfully, I think most people would say, Mike, at this point. But we rely on you to sort of give us the highs and the lows. And there have been plenty of highs as we end the year here when it comes to the markets, perhaps unexpectedly, given where we were some 7-8 months ago.
Yeah, almost completely unexpectedly, I guess, by most observers. And what's interesting about existing in the markets is that we've been living in 2021 for a while, because that's a lot of what the rally this year and the recovery and valuations, frankly, are pricing in. It's just obviously this rebound, this sort of sense that we had a kind of flash recession, a major shock, massive policy response, and market's been benefiting from a look toward that rebound that typically follows one of these shocks. Now, what I do find interesting is the overall market, really the big cap index, they've been in one of these very orderly grinds higher for most of this month. Yesterday, S&P touched 3750, backed right off of there. Who knows if that means it's kind of short-term running out of gas to a degree. But a lot of the stuff that everyone was pointing to and saying, this market's gone wild. There's a lot of speculative stuff happening here. They've come off massively in large part. So you want to look at Lemonade down 14% off its highs, Snowflake down 29% off its highs, Palantir off 26%, Moderna off 35%, the IPO index down 10%. So all the stuff that people were getting a little bit exercised about, that's saying that this market's gone around the bend, that's come in at the same time that the overall market has kind of hung in there. So who knows if we can just kind of bleed the patient in that way and have it feel better. But no doubt market's overbought. No doubt people are a little bit over confident about how next year looks. Nothing should surprise anybody in terms of a little bit of a shakeout in January. We've had some of those in recent years. But the overall structure of this market, really hard to argue with what's happening under the hood.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of incredible. It's not surprising, per se, to hear that you have some of those high-flying names that are that have come off notably in recent days, because, I mean, if you have been invested in one of those names, you've made quite a bit of money, presumably, on your investment. So why not take some profit there and basically, I guess, play with house money? And it will be interesting to see what happens in January. But, I mean, the S&P, and I realize that the markets closed marginally or fractionally lower yesterday, but we still hit fresh record highs again earlier in the session. 37th all-time high for the S&P, 21st for the Dow. This year, by the way, just this year, NASDAQ 66. if you were on some remote island, completely cut off from civilization and humanity as we know it, and you were just dialing back into the market here, you'd actually probably think that 2020 was a pretty good year, not realizing how incredible it was, the fastest plunge into bear market in history, and I believe the fastest recovery as well, to then see record high after record high. I'd also just note, I know I'm like a dog with a bone with this, but I continue to watch the dollar. 2-year lows for the dollar index. As traders are ignoring some of these U.S. stimulus delays, although we are going to get that $600 check, and that's already going out according to those tweets from Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. You got the dollar falling to the lowest since April 2018. You got the pound strengthening against the dollar on this AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine approval in the U.K., some other pretty notable FX moves right now. But of course, we see this weaker dollar, and that gives lift to things like commodities, materials, industrials, some of these sectors, some of these stocks that are part of that reflation rotation, if you will. Right, Mike?
Without a doubt. It's really all pretty much in tune. So dollar goes down, things priced in dollar goes up. Dollar goes down means global risk appetites are certainly in recovery mode, and we expect just globally central banks to stay, pretty much promoting the liquidity story for a long time. It all works. Credit markets, David, I think, we both use those as a touchstone, been incredibly firm. And here we have this story where credit spreads are now back to where they were pretty much before we got the COVID shock. The absolute level of things like junk yields is record lows. And we're talking about a perhaps incremental shortage of new corporate debt next year because issuance was so heavy this year. So what happens to all that money? People are chasing the same paper at this point.
Yeah, hard to imagine those junk spreads having tightened that way, Mike, given where they were for at least some period of time as we were so concerned, as the credit markets were obviously deeply concerned about not just a recession back in April, but the possibility of a depression is what people were talking about. And numerous bankruptcies didn't happen, did it? The ability to raise capital, obviously with the great help of the Fed, helped a lot of companies. The question now, Mike, becomes, are there sort of these zombie companies out there that simply by virtue of the nature of their ability to service their debt kind of keep going, even though their business model isn't necessarily one that would point to great growth ahead?
Without a doubt. And there are. The question is, to what result? They can kind of just be off to the side of the overall market. We have a couple of different markets, operating at the same time. Yet on the one side, you have companies with cash flow and they've been priced to a level that's basically matching up with where bonds are priced. So things that seem like they have steady cash flows or dividend yields, they look expensive because bonds look expensive. And now you have this other market where it's like this public venture capital kind of casino type deal happening, where basically people are looking for massive winners and just spreading their bets around. And there's a short term speculative piece of that. It feels like a seller's market. There's no doubt about it. You're seeing the SPACs, you're seeing the IPOs, but that can really carry on for quite a long time without it really having a reckoning.
Yeah, and of course, all of this speaks to, and David, you just touched on this, but all this speaks to just how incredibly involved the Federal Reserve is in these markets right now and buoying, what the activity that we've seen essentially, and not just the Fed, but also central banks around the globe in this broader conversation right now. And of course, that is one of the debates, that is one of the discussions that's really been starting to surface in recent weeks on Wall Street. I've seen quite a number of notes circulating about it, about this debate on whether we are going to see inflation begin to raise its head in a more meaningful way next year, regardless of what the Fed says in terms of policy and where it's going to and its anticipation of standing pat on low rates for the next couple of years. So that, I think, is also going to be one of those key things to watch, is going to be that yield curve and what long rates, for example, are doing and how the Fed has to react or doesn't have to react, depending on what we see in terms of an economic resurgence next year on these vaccine rollouts, which I know is going to be something we're going to talk about a little bit more right now, too, those vaccines, because we've got more news on that front, David.
Yeah, we do. Although if history is any guide, man, it's there's not going to be any inflation and we're not going to see higher rates because we've been sitting here every year for at least the last 11 years talking about that possibility.
So modern monetary theory, there we go. Being tested, I guess, in real life, real time.
We'll see. Yeah, exactly. You mentioned the vaccines, of course. The UK did grant AstraZeneca and Oxford emergency authorization use for their COVID-19 vaccine. Cases, of course, continue to rise around the world, certainly here in the U.S. And as well, Morgan, there is some concern in terms of the distribution of the vaccine, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, of course, being distributed here, but not going to come anywhere near what had been the hope of having as many as 20 million people inoculated by the end of December. And at our current rate, we're not going to get anywhere close to where we'd hope to. So there's certainly got to have to be a significant increase in inoculations fairly soon to start to hit some of the targets that have been out there.
Yeah, and certainly this is something President-elect Biden talked about yesterday, stressing his plans when he comes into office the end of next month to ramp that up and be more aggressive about it and potentially invoke the Defense Production Act more aggressively as well. That being said, It's curious to see where the bottlenecks are happening. I mean, you've had, what, more than 2 million, at least as of Monday, 2 million Americans inoculated, receiving one of those first doses of one of those two vaccines that have been approved for emergency use here in the U.S., and it's something like another 12 million that have been distributed and that are basically either at the state level or lower than the state level being distributed and awaiting, awaiting being administered, if that's proper English. I'm not so sure if it is. But it does seem like there are vaccines that are being created and being delivered, but getting into people's arms seems to be another story right now, at least. I think one of the other key things to keep an eye on, especially from an investor standpoint, is going to be how many, I know we've been talking about this too, David, how many people who are able to get that vaccine right now are going to get that vaccine right now, especially as we do get, and I realize that these are in the minority, but we are getting those reports of adverse reactions, uncomfortable or painful side effects in the day or days after. How many people are going to be willing to do that? And from a Wall Street, from an investor standpoint, whether that's even factoring into some of the models out there that are forecasting a strong return to economic growth and normalcy, if you will, next year upon this idea of herd immunity. Mike, also, in terms of pre-market movers, we do have some of these, and we've got some of those names up on the board right now, some of those biotech and pharma companies that have been developing vaccines. We're seeing some more movement because we have had some more headlines this morning.
Yeah, if you wonder exactly how much more is in that trade, I keep pointing out that the day of Pfizer Monday, when we got those great results from their vaccine candidate, November 9th, we traded up to 36.45 that morning. And even though it seems like the market's been doing going nothing but up, we're just a few percent above that right now. So it seems like more vaccines, the better. Everyone wants to see the rollout be successful. But you almost wonder if it's the premise of what's been happening in the markets for a while right now, that we are on this march and going to get more choices on the vaccine front, Dave.
Yeah. Finally, guys, wanted to come to a story that hit late yesterday. I think Reuters broke it. But Dan Loeb, Third Point, of course, urging Intel to explore strategic alternatives. It was a letter that was sent, I'm told, 20 minutes prior to that. They had a phone call letting them know it was coming. Of course, Intel has been under fire for any number of reasons, including vast underperformance versus some of its peers, its miss of a cycle in terms of manufacturing, a lead being taken to some extent in terms of the ability to produce smaller chips by the likes of Taiwan Semi and Samsung and others. There you see it. It did have a nice pop yesterday. You can see it there on the story. I do have a bit more to add here, of course. Listen, one of the key things is the fact that the nominating window here is January 15th. It closes. And so one would anticipate that Third Point, which has a position of roughly $1 billion, let's call it, all in-house, by the way. There's no sidecar, as we say, where they raise money from other investors, perhaps their existing LPs and the like. It is right now on swap, but they filed Hart-Scott. They can put it in their name pretty quickly. You say, well, as a percentage, still not that big. But of course, Third Point has a great deal of influence. And one would imagine there are a lot of long-only shareholders who share in some of the frustration that is out there in terms of what Intel has failed to accomplish over these last couple of years, as it has Well, it's lost the lead, hasn't it? I mean, take a look at the loss of market share to AMD and the performance of that stock versus AMD, for example. That is simply one example of sort of the frustration we're talking about. In its letter, though, a third point did not go after specifically Bob Swan, of course, the company's CEO, who joined us not long ago for an interview, sort of talked more just broadly about the loss of talent at the company and how they can try to start to rebuild that need for talent at Intel. Interesting to note, of course, Mike, that this is a company that trades at close to like 10, 11 times earnings, far below the group, far below, of course, the likes of some of its key competitors as well. And so if you're Loeb, you know, I look at the track record there, third point, they went into Sony, which has done extraordinarily well, even though Sony did not actually follow much of any of its advice, but it was the right stock, maybe not necessarily the battle won, but they did great. Disney, well, they sent that letter in, and then Disney did a lot of different things. That has performed extraordinarily well. So oftentimes, it's much more about the stock selection than the battle. But in this one, it may be about both, because they do feel there's little downside given how undervalued Intel is. And if you could get the multiple up to even, let's say, 15 times, you would obviously see a significant increase in the stock price. And there is frustration, as I said, amongst long onlys. And so one would imagine when they go to ISS, for example, how do you prove your case if you're Intel? That'll be interesting for them to do. They've also brought on Evercore as an advisor. We'll see what they can do in terms of that. And then this larger question of, well, can you do something with manufacturing that really adds value? Can you sell some assets potentially as well that adds value? Unclear. Is it a national champion? You know, I actually asked Bob Swan a few weeks ago when we had him on, Morgan, about this idea of national security being embedded in the overall play that Intel is in terms of semiconductors, given it is by far the largest U.S. manufacturer. Here's what he had to say.
We power 95% of the digital infrastructure today. And we have a large U.S. industrial base, and we play a very important role in national security and a safe and secure supply chain for the manufacturing and development of chips. In whatever decision we make, we will continue to have high volume manufacturing and invest in technology development here in this country.
Well, Mr. Swan under a lot of pressure already in terms of that decision, Morgan, and now, of course, a lot more pressure coming in the form of Mr. Loeb and Third Point.
Yeah, and it is interesting because it does seem like part of the way this argument is being phrased by Third Point is that essentially it is a national security issue in addition to being a company-specific and investor issue here. And of course, it comes as the government is looking to do things like incentivize more chip manufacturing here in the U.S. I don't think we're done talking about semis by a long shot. Not to mention its key competitors with all the big merger news that you've been covering so closely, David. But speaking of notable investors, it's back in the black for Bill Ackman in 2020. We're going to break that down after the break as well. So stay with us as futures point to a positive open.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to JanusHenderson.com.
It's been a comeback year for Bill Ackman and Pershing Square in 2020. Our Leslie Picker explains. Leslie.
Hey, David, that's right. Bill Ackman is on pace to notch returns of nearly 70% this year, making his Pershing Square one of the best performing hedge funds of 2020. Now, those gains weren't captured through his typical activism style, publicly pushing management to make changes like you were talking about with Third Point and Intel. No, these returns at Pershing Square were driven largely by a hedge in the credit default swap index markets put on back in late February and early March over concerns about the pandemic. And subsequently, Ackman unwound those hedges for a $2.6 billion profit, which he then plowed into his portfolio companies, plus reinstating some holdings. Those include some companies that have been depressed by the shutdowns, including restaurant brands and Hilton, but others like Chipotle, Starbucks, Agilent Technologies, and Lowe's have actually outperformed this year. And then Ackman raised this year's largest SPAC, or special purpose acquisition company, $4 billion there in hand to fund a future acquisition. Even though it has yet to find one, that SPAC is up 20% since its debut earlier this year, while Ackman, his overseas closed-end fund, is up about 80% this year. All in, Ackman is now managing $17 billion. Now, it's worth noting that this year's returns follow last year's gains of nearly 60%, putting the firm well above its high watermark to collect incentive fees. But those gains follow several years of negative returns, guys.
Wow. Yeah. You could have played him right, man. You would have nailed it. Leslie, thank you. That's interesting. 2 years in a row, very strong performance for Bill Ackman. Let's get a look at futures as we head to break. Of course, we've got an opening bell about 8 or so minutes away. You can see it right there at the bottom of the screen, 8:32, in fact. And there we are, looking for a higher open. Stay with us on Squawk.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable, high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration. Our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
On the street.
Watch Cat today. Baird naming Caterpillar its top idea of 2021 and raising its price target on stock up to $220. We got a lot more Squawk on the Street still ahead, so stay with us.
The Trump administration's plan to distribute vaccines is falling behind, far behind. But as I long feared and warned, the effort to distribute and administer the vaccine is not progressing as it should. A few weeks ago, the Trump administration suggested that 20 million Americans could be vaccinated by the end of December. With only a few days left in December, we've only vaccinated a few million so far. And the pace of the vaccination program is moving now, if it continues to move as it is now. It's going to take years, not months, to vaccinate the American people.
That, of course, if it were to continue, one would expect, Mike, might change investors' opinions about how quickly we can fully reopen the economy. Unclear, of course, at this point. You know, our former colleague Rebecca Jarvis tweeting as well. I've read her thread earlier about some real problems in Florida with senior citizens lining up and failing to get vaccines, staying overnight, some kind of bad scenes there. So it's certainly worrisome at this point. I think over 3,200 deaths yesterday as well in the United States from the virus.
Yeah, and there's been a little bit of a stutter step in that reopening trade, I would say, in the last couple of days. It sort of goes back and forth day, but it's very unclear what truly is embedded with any kind of precision in terms of an expectation of what we're going to call a return to normal. Is it, you know, at the end of the spring, mid-year? The market just seems to be okay with the idea that we're trending in that direction. And that slow vaccine rollout is frustrating and probably holds things up in terms of an economic rebound, but you know, each person vaccinated is better than not. So it's very tough to say. Also, difficult to know what President-elect Biden might be able to do, be willing to do in terms of trying to create more of a sense of either urgency on the vaccine rollout, but also in the meantime, if we're going to try to push for more restrictions. Markets shrugged a lot of that stuff off right now, just feeling like the underlying forces are just in favor of more activity next year than less at this point, Morgan.
Yeah, and it almost seems like, I don't want to say bad news is good news, but if it does take longer for the economy to reopen, there does seem to be this expectation baked in that stimulus will continue to happen in some form or fashion, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's probably, you know, a stabilizing thing for the markets at these levels as well. But again, we do have some of these positive, I guess, news headlines from names like AstraZeneca, Q CureVac. You've got some stuff coming out of China, Sinopharm as well, to keep an eye on in terms of more vaccines that could come online next year. In the meantime, we do have the opening bells, David, and it does look like more green than red for the S&P to start here. We're starting the day up 0.3%, 3738 is the level for the S&P.
Yep, and there you see it, of course, at the NYSE and the NASDAQ as well. And as Morgan said, of course, our real-time exchange back at headquarters. Mike, I like to come to you to, you know, sometimes I ask Jim Cramer when it's just the two of us what the key to the market is. I might sort of ask the same question of you in a broader sense, sort of what you may be focused on in terms of trading today or what you're looking at that may be a trend perhaps that you'll be following as we head into the year, the new year.
The trend really, and I think the key factor has been the calendar, to be honest with you. The very strong seasonal period, it's been very difficult to fight. And for weeks, we've been able to say sentiment is looking a little bit extended. People are getting a little too happy with this market. It's feeling a little bit too easy to trade and make profits. And that usually requires some kind of retrenchment or some kind of flattening out of the market. But during the seasonal period, very difficult to say. Now the question is, we roll ahead into January. You know, we did eventually have carryover of the rally, let's say in 2018, which looked kind of like these conditions. And then you got a big air pocket. Other things have to come along, though. There has to be a plausible excuse for something like that. So all that stuff, I think, is the backdrop. But the things to watch is the real risk appetite tells in the last couple of days that have hit some turbulence. I mean, Bitcoin's at a high right now, but you did see it back off a little bit. I mentioned the IPO ETF. Let's look, you know, who can we talk enough about the ARK ETFs? They, the flagship one is down 9 or 10%. They become almost a bellwether for this type of, you know, huge momentum trade in disruptive type technologies. Been phenomenal performers, phenomenal gatherers of assets. And then when the market's a little bit rough, those stocks become a target because they own so much of them. So all that stuff is, are we basically bleeding away some of the recklessness in some just pullbacks, routine pullbacks, but sharp ones in some of the crazier stocks and leaving the rest of the market more or less intact? That was the action on Monday. So the FANGs rally as some of the overheated stuff cooled off. So all those stuff, all those things, I think, are coming into play. Everyone's pointing to the runoff in Georgia next Tuesday. Obviously, yeah. Market's going to be watching it closely. It's totally unclear to me what the main inference is going to be almost on any outcome, because between stimulus probabilities, tax increase probabilities, and anything else you might think that change of control the Senate might bring, it's really unclear, Morgan.
Yeah. Meantime, I mean, one name that has actually continued to move higher and is moving higher in trade so far today are the cybersecurity names. BUG, the Global X Cybersecurity ETF, for example, it's up. I mean, it's up modestly this morning, but month to date, 23% really speaks to the pockets, I guess, of tech and of software. We are still continuing to see that demand. And perhaps no surprise, David, given the fact that we did see that massive SolarWinds hack and more, it seems on a daily basis, seems to come out about that. And of course, I think the read through there from an investor standpoint is that that's only going to continue to drive demand for some of these cybersecurity names that are publicly listed, and also potentially bring some more that are private onto the market in 2021. We'll see what happens on that front.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It's funny because, of course, it was a focus for us not that long ago, that massive Russian infiltration, Morgan. And we still don't really know how deep they are, where they are, but it's kind of fallen off a bit in terms of at least the news flow lately. But to your point, I guess, there is no doubt that it is going to continue to fuel the need for more and more security, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and just to go back to the broader markets, I mean, Mike, one of the things we haven't even brought up this week, really, is the Santa rally, the Santa Claus rally, which we are in the midst of. I just wonder, given the fact that this word is so overused this year, but we're in the midst of this unprecedented, I guess, scenario, if you will, from a macro standpoint, whether that's even going to hold up coming into 2021.
It so far is. You know, we've had a positive bias. We've hit the new highs. And let's be clear. This is talking about the five last trading days of a given year, the first two of the next year. It's just a one little patch of the calendar that tends to be the strongest of any. And mostly it seems to be portfolio positioning and flows into the new year in anticipation of the relief of tax loss and whatever the factors might be. But I think you've got what you on average get out of that upside. So and often it was considered to be more of like a warning signal if, in fact, you didn't get strength during this phase, then the following year you might hit some rough patches. So very difficult to extrapolate too much out of it, except to say it's been strong seasonally on a quarter-to-date base, really the last 2 months of the year. November and December, extraordinarily strong. And I actually saw some data, Ryan Dietrich over at LPL, talking about when we've had those periods of basically massive gains November, December, surprisingly enough, for some, the strength tends to continue. It has good implications if you go out several months or the following year. So haven't been many instances of this. The almanac doesn't necessarily tell you how to really run things. But it is interesting that that when we get these trending markets, it's been tough to knock them off course. I look at the bond market. Treasury yields have had no real give to them. They've been hovering 10 years under 1%, but in an uptrend, not really backing off no matter what the news has been. You see credit spreads incredibly strong, meaning very tight. So all of it is fitting together, and we're not seeing a lot of signs of stress. That's what I would watch for going into January, David.
Yeah. Something else I'm watching for, Mike, every day, of course, is SPACs. We talk about them every day for a reason. It's been the year of the SPAC.
You got a full screen for us, David?
Oh, yeah. I've always got them. You know that, Morgan. And we haven't brought it up three times before we actually talk about it. But today, today we've got, well, three different, you remember, you know, there's, to explain to our viewers, because we like to come back to it and sort of, it's still new to some. I mean, you've got when a SPAC actually issues its own shares and raises money. Then you've got the day when they announce their prospective deal, their merger, so to speak. And by the way, the bankers love this because it gets counted on the merger tables, and it's obviously also a way to go public, so it's an IPO route as well. But it is considered a merger, even though it's not really your typical merger and acquisition. And then you've got when they actually close the deal. And we've got kind of all three today, or at least the two of those three. Perella Weinberg going public via SPAC. Now, we'd heard about this a couple of weeks ago, there was reporting on this a few weeks ago, but they announced it this morning. DMY and Rush Street, you see it there. That's a gaming company that they're doing. And then Romeo Power is going to join us actually later, potentially a competitor for QuantumScape, which we know well, has been one of the great performers. Of course, it was Kensington was the SPAC. It's QuantumScape now because that deal closed back in November. In terms of the new generation of battery technology for EV cars. Let me focus a bit quickly on Perella Weinberg, of course, a firm I've known well, advisory. By the way, this is only the advisory part of Perella Weinberg. It's not the asset management part, which is owned by its partners, will remain private. So this is the advisory part of the firm, valuing it at around $975 million. The current partners and management of the firm will roll in some of their early investors, some Middle Eastern investors, Qatar and the like, are going to use this as an opportunity to sell some of their stock to the SPAC, some of their ownership, $110 million. The rest of the money that will be raised, they'll use for general corporate purposes. There is a pipe of $125 million coming in as well. We're talking, Mike, about a $500 million revenue number this year. They're saying as much as $575 million next year, and you can see how it's performing at this point. This is Betsy Cohen from this FinTech Acquisition Corp. She's done a number of these SPACs. But it's interesting, Mike, to see an investment banking firm, an advisory boutique going public in this manner, of course, a company that has, in fact, advised other companies on the SPAC route.
Absolutely. It's slightly amusing that we're talking about nominally a fintech SPAC that's buying, you know, basically an advisory firm that it's people talking to people. However, it's interesting that the strength in the investment banking boutique stocks, the ones that are already public, has been very profound. Moelis up 40%, Houlihan Lokey, Evercore, all up more than 40% this year. It's been one of the stronger parts of the financial services sector. PJT up 60%. So I do think this is a little bit of a sweet spot for that business. And you know, certainly very financially sophisticated seller and buyer in this instance. It really just seems like the more efficient mechanism to get to a public listing.
I'm glad you actually pointed that out. Yeah, sorry, Morgan,
no,
Mike, in terms of the performance of some of those boutiques, whether it is Evercore or PJT, as you point out as well, it is interesting. I mean, we're talking here as much as perhaps 16 times net income. Obviously, the margins are quite high at these firms. They're not huge taxpayers as well. And, you know, you base it off of revenue multiples and high margins. and potentially, Morgan, a good proxy for sort of economic activity. Everything I hear indicates that it is going to continue to be a fairly strong M&A environment, at least so far as we head into next year.
Yeah, and I also think it's going to be interesting to see how this trades and how this performs as well versus some of these other high-flying SPACs that we have seen this year. I mean, it's become, the vehicle has become, a preferred mode, I guess, if you will, for, as you mentioned, EV and some of these other sort of newer emerging technologies. Space, we've seen a number of space companies that are now doing these types of deals right now as well. So companies that are a little more uncharted, maybe like still very low revenues, let alone not even close to profitability. So to see a company like Perella Weinberg use this type of vehicle, it'll be interesting to see how it is received by Wall Street when it does start trading.
And, you know, I was just going to mention slightly off this, David, you know, JD.com today, stock's up just about 1%, not that much. It was up yesterday. So there's reports that they're considering spinning off the cloud and AI business. And you have to imagine that we have an incredibly ripe atmosphere for exactly this kind of thing, where it's a larger company looking for pieces of their corporate structure that looks something like some of the hottest sectors in the market. Now, Intel probably doesn't have a lot of that, but it's still talking about let's find ways to surface value of embedded assets that we can comp against some of the hottest stuff out there. Clearly, some of the SPACs are doing exactly this and more, less mature businesses. But that would seem like there's a ton of kind of potential energy in that part of the M&A deal market next year if, in fact, things, you know, hold together economically. You have $2 trillion of cash on corporate balance sheets and a lot of agitation probably for companies of that have not performed as well and the stocks have languished for them to try to catalyze things.
Yeah, and again, you're referring to JD's cloud and AI businesses potentially being explored, as you say, the feasibility in terms of a potential spin. Intel owns Mobileye. That's one name. Yeah. To Mike, to your point that perhaps would be more highly valued in the public markets yet again. Of course, they bought that business, Israeli-based business, a number of years ago. And being pushed by Dan Loeb to potentially think about selling non-core assets. Not clear. I don't believe that they've considered it at all at this point, based on what I've heard at Intel. All right, let's get a check on what else is driving today's market action. And for that, we get over to Bob Pisani. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Good to see you, David. We're essentially at new highs. Let's not quibble about a few points. And this is the market that just doesn't say no to anything. Vaccine news, good, bad, we're all right. Stimulus, not sure what exactly is going on with the $2,000 checks, but the market's okay. So take a look with what's going on. You'll notice emerging markets have just been doing great recently. It's a new high on the EEM there. Of course, weak dollar has been helping that out. We've got China, one of the best performing markets in the world. You want to watch MCHI, that owns Hong Kong, mainland China, and US-based China stocks. That's up 25-28% on the year. Tech, of course, has been the outstanding performer on the year, up 40% in consumer discretionary as well, of course. That's got Amazon in it. That's up 30% or so. The banks had a nice little rally in the quarter, but it's been flattish for the last month and it's still down. I mean, bank stocks down 10, 12, 13% on the year. Remember that, everybody who thinks there's some massive bank rally going on. There's been a bit of revolt on valuations in the last few days. Some of the smaller names that all the traders love to play have been down this week. They're up a little bit today, but you see the Palantirs and the DoorDashes, Plug Power, that's a favorite trading stock for the day traders, Cloudflare, Peloton, the other CrowdStrike and Etsy, they're all kind of down this week. These stocks have absurdly high valuations, of course, but they're favorites of the crowd. But I want to point out this exuberance is not just these smaller favorites. The mega caps are really pricey too. I mean, look at this. Apple's 31 times 2021 numbers. That's really pricey. Maybe it was higher in August a little bit, but other than that, you've got to go back many years to see Apple at 31. Microsoft too at 30. Alphabet at 28. These are really high. Again, maybe a little higher a couple months ago, but historically really high. Facebook, that looks like a bargain. 26 times forward earnings. So just bear this in mind with the fact that we're paying a lot of money for this stuff, and you're paying a lot of money for industrials too. All our favorite industrials, we're looking at Honeywell, 26 times forward earnings. I've been watching Honeywell for 20 years. Put up the industrials. I don't remember when Honeywell was 26 times forward earnings. Those are these are industrial stocks. They don't trade these kinds of multiples normally. And Caterpillar, which got that big upgrade today, that's in absurd territory too, really high. Ingersoll Rand and Norfolk Southern, you don't get big industrials that normally trade in the 20s very often. So this is a sign of optimism, on the reopening. You want more signs of optimism? It's all over the place. This ETF flows in December, I follow these flows very carefully. It's a good way, instead of looking at prices, look at the flows, because people have to come in and track creation of these new shares. People get enthusiastic, demand goes up, they have to go in, create new shares of the ETFs, and buy the underlying stocks. It's a great popularity contest. Guess what they're buying? Titanic inflows. I'm talking record inflows in the last couple months. What are they buying? Not big cap, not mega cap. They're buying small caps, emerging markets, large cap value, and even investment grade bonds. Good heavens, folks, this is the reopening story right there. You want, so put it all together. I don't want to be curmudgeonly about this. We have record stock prices. We have record in ETF inflows, which is a sign of exuberance overall. We have high margin debt levels. We had Thomas Petterfield on yesterday from Interactive Brokers specifically talking about that. And we've got high investor optimism. Okay. So what the market is saying is we are anticipating one lollapalooza of an earnings rebound beginning largely in the second quarter of next year. Let's hope that happens, because the market is very much positioned for exactly that to happen. Guys, back to you.
Yeah, it's interesting, Bob, and especially when you put up some of those charts of the industrials. I mean, Honeywell, I know it's been an industrial tech story in the last couple of years as well. So it seems like investors are buying into that. I also got to wonder the expectations around a big infrastructure deal, how much of that is also fueling some of those names too. Bob Pisani, thank you. It's time now for a bond report and some data, and Rick Santelli has that for us. Hey, Rick.
Hi, Morgan. Yes, indeed. We have our December, our final read for Chicago PMI. Last look, last month's final is 58.2, 59.5, which means the entire back half of 2020 from June till now is in expansion territory above 50. And what's really interesting, we know COVID, of course, has changed everything for 2020, but this particular number set has been sub 50 from July of 19 all the way through June of this year, when it popped in July back over that level. So it's very interesting to monitor, of course, the strength we are seeing. We haven't been in the 60s, higher than 62.4, which is this year's high, going all the way back to 2018. So it's really gotten quite powerful. Now let's get to the charts. Look at a 2 week of tens, which should jump right out at you. We keep getting into the mid 90s, right under the current high yield close, which is around 97 basis points, which takes us all the way back to March. We'll call it 10 months. But today, it's all about foreign exchange. Look at the dollar index. This is an April 2018 chart at the lowest levels in more than 2.5 years. Keep April 2018 in mind. Euro versus dollar, best levels, more than 2.5 years. Pound versus dollar, with Brexit coming very shortly, basically at the best level in 2.5 years. But this one is toying with the best level because it's pretty much equal to where it was trading just a few days ago, the 17th of December. So we really want to watch these current levels. The dollar versus the Chinese yuan, best levels in exactly 2.5 years in favor of the yuan. That's June of 2018. And finally, the dollar versus the Chinese yen, a 10-month high going back to March of this year. So the dollar index is really suffering under the weight of deficits, of course, as we continue to monitor not only how central banks are going to have to deal with it as we start to clear the COVID zone, but all central banks worldwide. Debt is universal in 2020. It's every country and every economy you look at. David, Morgan, Mike, back to all three.
All right, Rick, thank you very much. COVID-19, 1 year later, after the break. Stay with us.
Today marks 1 year of COVID-19 after a 34-year-old ophthalmologist in China posted a message in his WeChat group alerting other doctors that a new disease had emerged in his hospital. Eunice Yoon has a lot more for us on this anniversary. Eunice.
Thanks so much, David. Yeah, after that doctor, Dr. Li Wenliang, had posted the message, he was silenced by the police. He later caught the virus and then died from it, and is very much still seen as a hero here in China. So since then, life has relatively come back to normal. For example, at this sports bar restaurant, it's pretty full, considering all the concerns about the pandemic. Because of all the lockdowns over the year and the travel restrictions, especially on those wanting to come into the country, the pandemic has actually largely subsided. And in fact, businesses have been coming back. The economy is on track to post 8% growth in 2021. Life, though, isn't entirely the way it used to be, though. For example, here in Beijing, there have been several mini outbreaks. And because of that, 1.2 million people have been tested. And just as another personal anecdote, my New Year's Eve plans actually have been canceled. And I bring that up only because it just shows that businesses here are still losing money despite the efforts here to try to control the pandemic. Morgan? Yeah.
It's incredible that we're marking a year right now. Eunice Yoon, we do wish you a happy New Year's nonetheless. Thank you for joining us to finish off this hour. Major averages are all higher, and we've got another hour of Squawk on the Street coming up, so don't go anywhere.
You've been listening to the opening hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.